I'm often accused of being a dreamer, but what people sometimes don't recognize is the dedication and perseverance it took to make my dreams reality.
Howard Baldwin started as a minor league ticket counter and steadily worked his way up, eventually becoming a founding owner in the World Hockey Association, or WHA. Known as the Rebel League, the WHA was responsible for forcing the NHL out of its medieval stupor. In time, the two leagues would come together. Howard would play a crucial role in overseeing that merger in ending hockey's seven-year war. But during those 7 years, the League of the Outlaws put out seven great seasons of hockey. Among the teams, none would match the sustained success of Howard's. Essentially born out of a bluff, his New England Whalers were crowned WHA champions in the league's inaugural season. The Avco World Trophy would be far from the last piece of championship hardware Howard hoisted above his head. But now we're getting ahead of ourselves, because the path to that historic night in 1973, the entire path Howard took, was anything but straightforward. Nothing would ever be given. Everything would have to be earned. And he knew it, too. It's a journey that's hard to believe, especially considering that just months prior to the puck dropping on that first season, the Whalers were nothing more than an idea, a dream. At the time, one of Boston's leading sports columnists wrote that the chances of the 20-something-year-old successfully establishing a WHA team in New England were, quote, slim and none. After all, founding a professional hockey franchise requires an arena, players, and money. Howard had none of the three. But he had ambition. He wasn't afraid to dream.
To be accused of being a dreamer really isn't such a bad thing, so long as you're willing to work hard, to persevere. This is the story of what it took to make my dreams come true. I was one of four boys, the third. Ian, the oldest, Michael, and then me, then Philip. Philip was a five-year afterthought.
I'm Howard's oldest brother, Ian Baldwin. And I call him Howdy. So I'd have to be artificial to call him Howard. Okay? So I'll call him Howdy. I have a lot of memories of him, of course. One is he had this amazing bleached blonde head of hair, curly. So he was a pretty angelic-looking fellow.
We grew up in a fairly privileged life in Bedford, Mount Kisco, New York, and it was really wonderful. I have no complaints whatsoever about my childhood. It was a good, tight-knit family, and my friends were good friends at school and still friends today, those that are up on all fours. We did what the kids did there in those days growing up, hung with each other and had good friends and ran pretty free.
And right next to us was a horse farm that belonged to a guy who lived on the hill above us called Colonel Schiff. And the guys who maintained the farm, cut the fields, did the haying, tractors and all of that, they took a shine to Howard, to Howdy. And so my first memories of him are them riding with him, you know, on their laps, because he was only three years old. And, you know, they take these tractors and mow fields and bale hay and so forth with little Howdy in their laps. And I think he learned to curse at a very early age.
When Howard wasn't riding horses or running through the neighborhood, his dad had him and his brother skating.
So he had us on skates when in the same time we started walking. I remember being on double runners back there in Mount Kisco, just skating on the driveway. And then when we would go skate during the weekends, it's kind of like the Canadians played the game. We had a beautiful lake and we'd all go down to the lake and play.
Yeah, that was White's Pond. White's Pond was a great place. It's now a big golf course. But you used to walk up a, well, you know, as a kid, I remember it as a hill. It was probably no more than a gentle slope. And then you'd walk down. It had the feeling of being almost a volcano cone, all pine trees all around it. And a little shack with a wood stove where people changed, got on their skates. And from very early age, my father had us all out there. They'd have great shinny games on those ponds, on that pond. You know, you had low boards, no more than a foot off the ground, a couple of nets. No one wore a helmet. You weren't allowed to really slap shot, okay? So I don't think we even had, no one played with shin guards even. So you weren't allowed to lift the puck. But it was great hockey. And that was a kind of an environment that Howdy and I grew up in.
My father was a great college hockey player at Harvard. If you look him up in the class of 33, he was one of the top amateur players in the country.
And he co-holds with the famous Cleary brothers of the 1950s the record for the most goals ever scored by a Harvard hockey player. And that's an old record. That's 90 years old at this point. Our father had a nickname called Iron Mike, which was given to him by reporters, Boston reporters, when he played for Harvard. So we were all in awe of Iron Mike, our dad. He was a vivid character.
So my father had me playing in the big game when I was like, you know, really young, but I couldn't keep, you know, I couldn't compete with the players in that game because they were good. So they stuck me in the goal and with no pads because you weren't allowed to lift the pucks. And I remember stopping one shot the whole year on my foot, and I cried so hard I said, I'm never going in the goal again.
You know, he has a better memory than any of his brothers. He's got a very good memory. And I don't remember that. But I can assure you it's totally plausible because we could be a little sadistic. I don't think we bullied him. We might have verbally abused him a little bit. Probably did.
Growing up in a house with three brothers, it was inevitable that Howard would develop a strong sense of ambition and will to compete. On the ice, he was developing into a pretty good skater and hockey player, too. He wasn't having nearly as much success in the classroom, though.
He was a rotten student, and proud of it, I guess. Well, we were all meant to go to a school called St. Paul's in New Hampshire. That's where my father went, my grandfather went, my great-grandfather went. And my brother Ian went, and my brother Michael went, and I did not go. I went to a school called Salisbury School, which I loved. My problem as a student was I couldn't concentrate. There were days when I just couldn't, you know, you're given a lesson to read and all, and there are days, even today, there are days where I'm given something, and I'll just say, I'm putting this down, I can't concentrate on it. I'll read it at another time.
That he struggled in the classroom did not matter to Howard's classmates. Everyone seemed to take a liking to him.
But he was a natural leader, and Howdy was elected president of his class. And so he had a natural charisma, and people looked up to him. His people skills. Because he had to get along with a lot of different kinds of people in order to, for instance, do the merger and be one of the teams that went through all the way to becoming part of the NHL. That was a bitter struggle. And the NHL was not friendly. I mean, teams like Montreal and Toronto, what are you talking about? They didn't want to see this happen. I'd go back to the tractor and the guys he met from a very early age on the tractor that came from a different background than him. He's a guy who is he's open to being with talking to getting to know any kind of person. He likes stories, he likes to tell them, and he likes to hear them. And so, you know, he's not a guy with what you'd call social prejudices.
Though his people skills were admirable, there was no hiding the academic struggles, which set him apart from the rest of the Baldwins.
But Howdy, I think, probably in some ways more than the rest of us, didn't fit the mold.
Not that it was an easy mold to fit into.
My older brother went to St. Paul's, Columbia. Michael did everything right. St. Paul's, Harvard, J.P. Morgan. You were meant to go to Harvard. And needless to say, I didn't go there.
There was no chance he was going to go to Harvard.
You know, I knew I wasn't going there from day one. I just knew I wasn't going to go there. But everybody, my cousins and everybody there, you're all meant to go to some highfalutin prep school and then to some highfalutin college, which was Harvard. 90% of the people in my family, there are two or three buildings named after them at Harvard.
Lofty expectations came with the name. Howard always knew he had big shoes to fill. His feet, though, they never seemed to fit.
Everyone accepted the fact that Howdy wasn't a classroom academically inclined guy anyway, and we had that precedent. I think where Howdy had the most difficulty kind of socially was with his mother's side of the family, who were mainly from Boston, all of whom went to Harvard, and it did make you feel kind of uptight and, oh my God, I didn't go to Harvard. What's wrong with me?
Howard was well aware that the question of what to do about Howdy was one the whole family was asking.
You couldn't help but have a sort of a chip on your shoulder. And so when you went to a lot of the functions, family functions, particularly and most of them were on my mother's side, you felt, God, how do you measure up?
If he didn't start making some decisions for himself, Howard knew he would start to sink. Sinking was never an option, though.
And so right away, you start formulating plans over making your own mark, but differently. When you're faced with that, you tend to think out of the box, you know what I mean? And sort of come up with a path that sort of suits you, meaning me. And that's what I did. I really did think out of the box from the time I left prep school. I didn't go to college. I went to the Marines.
At the age of 19, Howard packed his things and set off.
I took the train. We all got on the train. I signed up in Boston. So we took the train, and as the train came down the coast, the Atlantic coast, we picked up more and more recruits. And then when we pulled into a little town called Yemassee, South Carolina, and I remember this is back in 1961, it was dirt streets. Train pulls in, we're on that top step, and there are these two drill instructor sergeants. And the whole town was out. Now, when I say the whole town was out, there's maybe 100 people, but they used to love to see the recruits, mostly white boys, coming in there to Yemassee and getting screamed at.
You're not standing still. You're shaking like a leaf.
Which we did. And I stood on that. I tell everybody, I stood on that step looking down and said, okay, this is the first sort of mistake, or this is the first event in my life where I can't call home and say, I don't want to see this one through, because once you're in, you're in. And then from there, we go on the bus to the actual island. Paris Island is really an island.
Prior to enlisting, Howard had plenty of warnings that the training was going to be tough.
The Marine Corps was traditionally the most difficult branch of the service.
But that was exactly the kind of challenge he was looking for.
My father was in the Marines. A lot of my family were in the Marines. But for me, I just felt that the way to make my mark was to pick the hardest things to do.
It was a Spartan life, but Howard was not going through it alone.
Right across from my bunk was a guy named Bob Meyer. If you look him up, he was a bonus baby. And he was regarded as a real phenom for the Yankees.
Before embarking on a 10-year big league career, though, Bob was right there alongside Howard and the other recruits, pushing through the brutal training.
Where he had no television, no radio, and no speaking to anyone unless you were spoken to by the drill instructor. As it ended up, we had about 75 or so recruits in our company in a barracks there. And it's just happened that Howard was about almost directly in front of me on the other side of the aisle. So he and I would share smiles and smirks and whatnot. That was our way of communicating.
In fact, it was the only way that recruits were able to communicate with each other. Speaking was not allowed.
We never spoke for 12 weeks. Between us, you know, we talked to the drill instructor when they spoke to us, and that was the extent of interaction.
Despite the inability to communicate, the boys were doing well in their training. That is, until Bob made one crucial mistake.
I decided to do something on my own, and that was to write a letter to my brother.
And he wrote a letter home, and the goofy, you know, he never should have done it, but, you know, they'll read your mail.
And, of course, everybody's in front of their bunk cleaning their rifle, as they should have been, and I should have been, but I didn't. And I was at the back of my bunk writing a letter to my brother. And of course, they caught me, and they brought me up in front of everybody, made everybody stand at attention in front of their bunk. And then the drill instructor proceeded to read the letter to my brother. "Dear Bill," I started out, "I'm in this Marine Corps down here in Parris Island, and it's hot as hell, and it sucks."
You know, they're a nasty bunch. And say he was complaining about how clean they had to keep the floors and everything.
And, you know, I went on from there and told them how fantastically clean the floors were. We cleaned them every day, two or three times, and they were so clean you could eat off of them. And then the drill instructor says, "Mr. Private Meyer, we're going to make sure that you follow through with your statement to your brother." And they brought some food in and threw it on the floor and had me get down there and grovel in it and eat a few, you know, spoonfuls. But it was just a hassle from then on.
So the drill instructor would go by at night, and they'd just pound him on his arm, pound him, and say, "You'll never pitch for the Yankees. Your career is over."
Not only did they hit my arm, but then he proceeded to tell me that he was going to wreck my arm so that I wouldn't be able to wipe my ass.
And after about a week, you know, we hardly were ever allowed to talk to each other other than when you went to the head of the bathroom. And I said, "Geez, Bob, how are you holding up? Are you okay?" And he said, he just looked at me and winked, because he was a very laid-back, cool guy. And he said, "I'm fine. These guys are so dumb. They're hitting me on the wrong arm. I'm a southpaw."
Such was life training for the Marines.
It's an experience that is indescribable, you know, because they do treat you not nice. And yet you don't realize how nasty they are until you're confronted with it. And they'd always say, "You guys are going here, there." They'd wake us up in the middle of the night. There was a Cuban crisis, and they'd wake us up in the middle of the night and bring us out and say, "You guys are all being shipped off to Cuba." Now, we had rifles, but none of us had even fired the rifles. And so we're looking at each other and saying, "How the hell are we going to go to Cuba? We can't even shoot." It's all a game. You know, they try to break you down. What they do, and they still do it, they try to break you down so that you don't really think for yourself, and then they build you back up to conform to their to their standards of following orders no matter what and all.
The grueling training of the Corps was a challenge like he'd never experienced before. Those long days and grueling nights, they were demanding, exhausting.
But what it did is it gave you great, it gave me discipline, and it taught it, and it gave you sort of a sense of responsibility, because you don't have any room for error with some of the things they have you do and some of the things they teach you. So it gives you a sense of accomplishment to be able to say, you can take that kind of crap that they give you, physical crap, mental crap, and then you get a lot of knowledge. I mean, there are a lot of things I could do that I couldn't do before I went in there, I assure you of that. And I can do them today in my mind, but my body won't respond. You know, when you're in a situation like that or other situations I've been in, you have to have the ability to, I always say, adjust, adapt, and survive. And so that's exactly what I did. I got pretty good at that.
Those abilities, that dogged determination to see even the toughest of challenges through, though Howard didn't know it then, these intangibles would come to pay dividends in short time. Because while getting through Paris Island was one thing, when it came to figuring out what to do afterwards, that was a whole other ballgame.
When I came out, I really didn't know what to do, but I liked Boston, and I had friends at Harvard, and I figured I'll go to BU.
The year was 1962, when Howard found his way back out onto the ice. Though he made the varsity team, he came to realize college hockey wasn't for him.
There was too big a gap, you know, from the time I played at prep school to the time I tried out at college. It's just too big a gap. You missed too much. So now Jack Kelly will always tell you, well, you made the team, I was going to keep you on the team. And yet I knew I wasn't, you know, I wasn't up to as good as these guys were. I mean, I could compete with them in scrimmages and all, but these guys were good. And they were, because the year I left, they won the NCAA, so I felt good about that.
During their short time together, Howard impressed Jack because he wasn't afraid to say what was on his mind, and Jack appreciated that. And Jack, too, made an impression on Howard. He was strict, a disciplinarian, but fair. Their paths would cross again almost a decade later when Jack came on as the general manager and coach of Howard's Whalers. Beyond the ice, things weren't as pearly. In the classroom, it was much the same story as it had been at Salisbury.
And I did go to class at BU, but to say that I was an ineffective student would be the understatement. I really was just putting in time there. And when I left, I just said to my parents, it's a waste of money to spend to have me go here. It's not fair to you. So when I left BU, I said, hey, you just go, and you, not to be corny, but life is, you get on a nature trail, you go in the woods, you get on a trail, you go down a trail, and if all of a sudden that big old ugly bear there, you say, I think I'll go back and take another trail. And that was pretty much what I did and what I've done. Doesn't always work, but you don't look back over your shoulder and have regrets.
That trail led him to baseball.
The baseball thing was absurd. I never played at high school and all, but I did play at BU. I got my letter at BU.
And so, with one season as a second-string catcher with the Terriers under his belt, Howard decided to see if he could go pro. He knew of a camp being held down in Florida that some major league scouts were going to attend, but he had no way to finance his trip. He hadn't asked to borrow money from his parents yet, and he didn't plan on starting now.
And I knew I was driving to Florida. I had about a month to earn some money. So I did some odd jobs, like painting, and then I read an article in the Boston Globe about, you know, guinea pigs. They needed guinea pig for pain. I said, what the heck is that? So I go, and there's this little office. They said, they wire you up, and they shoot you full of they give you shocks. You understand what I mean? They give you shocks. And they pay you And then they'd bonus you based on your tolerance. The one thing I've always been proud of is that he said, thus far anyway, I had the highest tolerance for pain of anybody that they ever experimented on. And I said, well, that shows you how much I need money to get down to Florida. Just another experience. I would have been a good prisoner of war, I guess. So I left BU and went down to Florida and tried out with a team, the Tigers. I tell young people this all the time. If you have a passion to do something, try it when you're young. And yet it was absurd at my age going down to try to play major league or minor league baseball. I mean, I was too old. I should have been 17, 16, or 18. I just knew that I loved sports and I was pretty good at sports playing them, but not good enough. I didn't make the Tigers, needless to say. But yet I'm glad I did it, because now I never could look back and say, gosh darn it, I should have tried that. When you're really young, you don't have fear. And I had done things like go into the Marines or whatever. So I didn't have fear of failure.
A future playing professional baseball? Howard now knew that was not in the cards. By this point, he had dropped out of college too. But even still, he remained determined, never lost his drive. He began the search for a new trail.
And if I couldn't be on the field or on the ice, I wanted to try to figure out something off the ice. And that's what I did.
Except it didn't all come together quite so nicely. There were a few hiccups in the road. Upon leaving camp with the Tigers.
So I met up with a buddy that I went to prep school with. And we spent about 4 or 5 weeks going to every high life fronton. I don't know if you've ever heard of that sport, but it's really a fun sport. Particularly fun to gamble on. And ran out of money and came home with the tail between my legs and, you know, got a job in a sporting goods store selling equipment and that kind of a thing. I worked the floor, you know, somebody would come in and then the fellow that owned the store said, well, maybe what I ought to have you do is I'll give you the same base salary, but then a commission and go around to the various schools trying to sell they dealt in a lot of school uniforms and stuff like that. So I said, okay, I'll try it. Well, I hated it. And then mercifully, the school that I went to in Hawthorne, New York, they needed a baseball coach. And so I got the job. I pretty much pitched batting practice and frankly had a pretty good time. It was almost like I was one of them playing. It was good fun.
The work rekindled his love for working in sports and also helped him to come to an important realization.
Then I knew, okay, you're not going to make it as a player, as a baseball player or a hockey player. So let's do the next best thing. So I used some of the contacts and relationships my father had to meet people that were on the edges of sport, you see? And to try to figure out a way to somehow get in there on the ground floor. My father had introduced me to a guy named Bill Putnam, who was a lending officer at J.P. Morgan. And I had met Bill and had a great meeting with him. You know, we shook hands and he said, look, if I ever hear of anything or anything like that, I'll give you a call. Bill then left and got the Philadelphia Flyers franchise with Eddie Snyder and with Jerry Wallman. And then he remembered me again. And he said, come on down. I have a position for you with the minor league team we just bought. And I just said, no questions asked. I'm on my way. And that's what I did.